Hey, what's up? This is John Baisley from Baroness.
Hey, this is Seb from Baroness.
And you are listening to
Toilet of Hell.
There's part of me that gets really offended with our scene when people get offended with our scene, if you're in the scene. If you like extreme metal and something offends you, why are you here? This is a place for the offensive things. This is not a place for everyone else. If we wanted to write music that appealed to everybody and made everybody feel good and warm and fuzzy inside, we would not be here.
Defecate. Choke on my shit. Urinate. Drown in my piss. Godless. Hater of the world. Absurd.
Oh. With this shit
not
again.
Not this again.
Not this again.
Oh, not this again.
Fucking bullshit!
No, God, please, no! 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 No!
Where are the seasons that have
to the Toilet of Hell radio show. I am, once again, not Joe Thrashing Hill. I am 365 Days of Horror, and with me is... See, we usually go deep, scary voices when saying your name, but since Joe's not here, I'm going to try something a little different. With me, as always, is...
It's like you touched my soul, man, and just melted my icy core, and now my heart grew three times that day. That's what
did
I wanted
you like
to hear.
Did you like the change? Is that better?
That's better. You know, man, I was the true metal dude back in the day. Like, when I first met up with you guys, I gave you stupid bullshit like Angel Witch to play on the show. Like, I was way into that ludicrous, giant-haired, new wave of British heavy metal sort of tone where you wear spandex leopard pants and it's actually still cool. We need to bring that shit back. And not just in an ironic sort of Sex Panther bullshit way or whatever they're called.
I mean, there's kind of been a revival with the traditional heavy metal sound. Bands like Visigoth and Night Demon are kind of brought it back in a little bit of way, not the over-the-top Steel Panther sort of way, but really focusing on the riffs and the traditional metal sound.
Visigoth is super cool, and I remembered I was introduced to them because I just saw this band photo of them where, and this was years ago, they're all standing together. They got like their aviator sunglasses on and their leather jackets and just trying to look as metal as fucking possible. And one guy just did not get the memo. He's just in his t-shirt and his pants and he's just in his like black frame glasses and his short haircut, just not giving a shit.
And is it like, is he wearing a Legend of Zelda shirt? Is that the picture?
Something like that. Yeah, I think it was a Legend of Zelda shirt. It's like, I mean, man, that's just drummers for you. You got to get a guy who can drum, and there's only so many in your town.
God damn it, Jeff.
Jeff. Way to go, Jeff.
We're in week two of not having Joe here, and I think we really got to start cleaning the place up because he's coming back soon. There's just pizza boxes everywhere, soda and beer cans, nudie magazines everywhere. We're going to have to sweep it under the rug real quick.
Not to mention all these hot, gorgeous, naked women just laying, lazily upon all of our comfy areas waiting for us to return.
Our comfy areas.
Yes, comfy areas. Not our personal comfy areas, but I meant like the couch and the chairs.
A bearskin rug.
Yeah, right. The big bearskin rug before the roaring fire.
So since Joe's not here, I can continue my drinking weird stuff. This is a continuation from our show last week where I drank horrendous squash honey water.
Squash water. It's what you paid for.
Hopefully this is better. This is one of those, I don't know if you've seen it. It's a glass bottle drink where it has to come with a bunch of directions because you have to like take the top off, turn it upside down, push it into your drink. And it's clearly not a drink made for Americans because it has instructions to it. But it's neon green and it is melon flavored.
Wait, so you sort of do you have to like pop something to pour the ingredients into the drink?
So the directions are like, remove the seal, detach the plunger from the center of the cap, place the plunger on top of the bottle, press down firmly, and I don't know if my weak American hands can handle this.
No, probably not. But you're going to try on the air, and I think that everybody is going to raise their hands and lend you their key so that you can have all the power you need to open this bottle. So if everyone listening, raise your hands and lend your spirit energy to Jordan. He needs it.
We're going to have to edit this a bit because I don't even know what I'm doing. I took the cap off, and it says there's a plunger that you need to remove. Oh, there we go.
Oh, damn it.
I literally had to like push it out. It's only halfway out.
I wanted to have like 5 minutes of struggle that I was definitely not going to edit and put on the show.
I was definitely concerned with. All right. Yeah, here it goes. All right.
You good?
Problem solved. That's one. Now pushing it in. A drink shouldn't have a plunger, by the way.
Yeah,
like,
what the
come
fuck?
On.
It's got to be. There's some compartment in there where there's just like a very strong syrup or something that gets released into what would otherwise be a cleaner water. I mean, do you have to like shake it at all at a certain point?
No, I think it's one of those drinks where it has like a little like jelly ball in it or candy ball. And once you push it down, like that goes into the drink. So I solved that. I've solved that. Now we're going to do Middle East peace process and then world peace. So I'm going to be the new Kushner.
It's like the fucking impossible Lotus puzzle that one guy did on YouTube for 25 minutes.
So it's open. I'm smelling this. It's a heavy, like, Jolly Rancher smell to it.
Beautiful. So what was the, I'm sorry, I might have missed the flavor. Like, what's the description of it again? Is there any?
Melon.
Just melon.
Just melon.
All right.
Carbonated Ramune drink, artificial melon flavor. And it's actually made, it's a product of Japan, but it's made in California, or distributed in California. So there's English on it. But here, let's give this a try.
Yeah. Bring the melon to your melon and let's see.
It's not bad, actually. I mean, it's very fake tasting and very sugary, but it's way better than that melon water gourd water I drank last week.
Oh, yeah. It's when you get the American market, we love our tasty fake bullshit. That's just
we
sugar
really
and noise. That's what we like.
Well, it's like blue raspberry doesn't taste like raspberries. There isn't even such a thing as blue raspberry. Raspberries are red.
I heard that Japan used to be one of like the healthiest places, or certain sections of Japan used to be some of the healthiest places on earth, just like extreme longevity, like average people were living to be 126, 127 years old, that kind of shit. Because there was just so much seafood and like sweet potato in their diet. And then, the long black hand of capitalism, America just started opening up all sorts of markets in Japan for all sorts of products with high fructose corn syrup and fast food and otherwise. And like now they're having a real like hypertension and diabetes problem like everywhere else, all because of us.
KFC is the biggest fast food place in Japan. It's huge.
Yeah, like don't they love it's like a big thing for Christmas, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think they dress up Colonel Sanders and do all sorts of things. So yeah, you're welcome, Japan. You know,
fuck that. We should get Joe to bring us back some Japanese KFC and see how it adds up.
I'm hoping for weird Kit Kat flavors,
like a KFC Kit Kat flavor.
It might exist. I mean, they have wasabi and squid ink and choco banana and all sorts of stuff. So it's entirely possible there's a fried chicken Kit Kat out there.
Delicious. So we got a little busy last weekend, and currently at the date that we're recording this, it's a Sunday. It's the 14th of April. But last Saturday, me and Jordan, we met up. It's like you guys know the old Predator scene with Bennett and the two guys just walking through the room and calling each other a son of a bitch and just clapping hands together and just flexing muscles. That's always what it's like when Jordan and I first get together. He always wins. He's extremely strong. So
you son of a bitch. And then we shake hands and then we're both out of breath.
Yeah. The CIA has me pushing too many pencils. So,
you had to get off that desk.
That's right. So, we got together because, not only was there a pretty amazing lineup, in an area fairly close to us. I think, what do you got, like an hour to drive?
It's like the midway point between where we both live.
Pretty much. So it's the Palladium in Worcester, and the show was Zeal and Ardor and Def Heaven and Baroness. Def Heaven and Baroness were co-headlining. They were switching back and forth each night. And so Jordan, with his magical PR powers, was able to land us an interview with John Dyer Baisley, the main man, the guy himself, and Sebastian, the drummer. Sebastian has a last name. We're going to get it. I'm going to edit it in after I Google it. But they introduced us as Sebastian, you know? It's like, okay, he's Sebastian. Just remember the crab and you're fine.
Well, it's like Sebastian or Seb. Either one works. But they were really great. Had a chance to go on their bus, much like our time with Winter Sun, although we didn't have to take our shoes off this time.
Yes. Like real fucking Americans.
And we went to their back room, which sounds super naughty, but it was about a 5x5 box with a little tiny space for us to sit. And we got to chat about a lot of really cool things, and I really appreciate how open they were and willing to discuss the music, the tours, Golden Grey, John's artwork, all sorts of stuff. So I'm really happy with the interview. They were great. Fans of the band will definitely love this interview. And people that know them just a little bit, I think, will find some things interesting. And they had a lot to say, which is always nice. Sometimes these interviews, you can tell people don't care. You can tell they've gone through the motions 10 times that day. So it's really nice that they were interested and engaged. And I'll always appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was such night and day between the guys from Winter Sun, who were actually like nice enough guys. They were just very stoic, quiet Finnish men who just gave short answers and did the best they could. Whereas, you know, it's like John's just both these guys, they just have such pros and such great answers, and they just know exactly how they feel and they know how to put it into words. And they're very warm and inviting. It was just such a cooler atmosphere. We were joking, we were laughing. It was a much better interview. So we'll go ahead and lead it in, and we'll let you guys hear it. First and foremost, again, it's on a tour bus. The bus was idling, and the fan was going in the back. So we're gonna get some serious editing in there. We're gonna make it sound great, but just keep that in mind. It's kind of a raw and dirty back of the tour bus interview, so you know this is how we do it. We do it raw dog, so we're gonna have a great old time. So this is going to be Jordan and myself, Breno, interviewing Sebastian Thompson and John Dyer Baisley.
You are listening to the Tool of Hell Radio Show. We have live in person with us Sebastian and John from Baroness. How's it going, guys?
Good. How you guys doing?
Good.
We are doing well. This is towards the tail end of your tour with Deaf Heaven and Zeal and Ardor, and we're eating an apple, and it's getting a little bit on the floor, but that's okay. So other than the apple, how's the tour been going?
It's amazing.
Yeah, it really has been an awesome tour since day one, really.
And I've seen you a bunch of times now, originally with Tombs, years back. Not here, this was in like Kingston, New York, in a tiny like gallery. This was years ago.
Oh, you were at that?
I was at that.
No way.
So I've seen you a bunch of times. I've been with you.
No.
This is 2010, maybe earlier. This was like Red Album, I think.
This was Red Album. This is when Brian was playing guitar forward. It may have even been before that. Jeez, that was a long time.
It was a long time ago.
That was great.
I've seen you with them. I've seen you with Paul Bearer, Inter Arma. This is kind of, Deaf Heaven's maybe a little bit heavier than what you're used to playing with, at least on a constant tour, maybe not festivals.
I don't know. Last time we were here in Worcester, for instance, we played with Meshuggah. That's
true. Good point. I take that back.
Maybe too heavy. No, that was awesome.
I mean, Deaf Heaven's heavy, but they're also, you know, it's kind of melodic and
it's pretty
and romantic, also. You know,
of course. Yeah.
Do you, especially with this kind of switching back and forth co-headline tour, do you feel you have to kind of adjust how you play, or maybe how you present yourself, or maybe even songs that you play, to kind of fit with maybe a crowd that's looking for something heavier?
Not really. You know, I think our mentality has always been, you know, that we're either, we always tend to be something of an outsider on certain bills, or, you know, I guess it's just kind of fun to be a stick in the mud sometimes. And, you know, if the audience is expecting, you know, If Deaf Heaven's going to provide them with blast beats, you know, rough vocals, then why not we present, you know, the contrasting sound? It seems to me like on this tour, especially with Deaf Heaven, that the sounds are very complementary, and it's not that either band is like more or less intense or more or less heavy than the other band. We just have like decidedly different sounds.
Yeah, just different ways to go about heavy.
I think also both bands, we really, this might sound like too easy, but we really do have like a co-headlining mentality. Like we're both like, it just seems very, like it doesn't feel like the first band is opening, really. It feels like we're both headlining every night.
Yeah, like for instance, like just as a sign of like how equal and cool this has been, like nobody does not. No matter what, it's just there hasn't been an encore in 5 weeks.
Wow.
And that's just to say that there is no more important,
just like a sign of respect, like mutual respect.
Sure.
Absolutely. And I've always wondered about that with co-headliners. I mean, is it I don't know if you've ever had a crowd reaction where they really wanted one and you didn't end up giving it, or if it's just you kind of know the role and you just don't do it for the reason that you just said. So
this is the first co-headlining tour we've ever done.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so I don't know exactly how it is on other tours.
Sure.
With the exception of the fact that I've been to, and I've been privy to other, you know, co-headline or like co-build tours, and I have seen like a discrepancy in ego, and I have seen people get their feelings hurt about it, which is probably why it was so important. You know, I think George and I talked a little bit before the tour, you know, on several occasions. It just didn't, it never seemed like it really was going to be an issue, but
yeah,
we made sure that, like, right off the bat, that we just nipped that in the bud.
It felt a little weird the first couple of nights, not playing an encore,
yeah,
but now it feels totally normal to just get off stage and hang out.
You get to go to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, or do other things.
Sure.
But no mystery there. Well, we promise not to hang around then. We'll know you guys.
Well, so, that's like with, I don't know if you guys heard, but with the Misfits, Doyle von Frankenstein said not that long ago, he hates meet and greets. He has to do meet and greets. It's $50 to meet him. He doesn't want to do it. He wants to be left alone. I guess, how do you as a band that's doing well, that's well known, how do you kind of respond to that? Or is that something, do you ever think about at all?
Obviously there are, you know, each musician's got his own mentality, and that's his or her mentality, and that's not something. I'm not gonna presume to know a thing about, you know, what Doyle goes through on a day-to-day basis. I know that for in Baroness, our success has come almost entirely from our connection with our fans, and I don't say that in a presumptuous or pandering sort of way. I mean, I literally believe that our band has done well because we don't put a premium on the conversations that we have with our audience after the show, before the show, during the show. We make sure that it's as easy as possible to meet us. If, you know, if we've got assuming we've got the energy, and you know, we try not to hide backstage too frequently. And you know, in years past when we've toured, I'll do like little art pop-up things in different cities. I do it pretty frequently.
I've been to one of those, actually, in Providence.
So you've seen, like, they work as a meet and greet without our audience having to win a contest or pay for something. It's just, you know, come on out, like, we're here to show you, you know, we as musicians are here to show you that it's not, there's no real boundary between us as musicians and you as an audience. It's pretty equal there, too.
I've always, I mean, I appreciated when I had the chance to meet with you at one of those pop-ups that you took the time to talk with everyone, whether someone wanted to talk about artwork or about your pedal boards.
Yeah, it's something you're kind of known for. I feel like a lot of my friends on Instagram, I'll always see a picture of, like, Smiling John with an arm around somebody, you know? And it's just cool to see that because you don't always get that. Like, you brought up that example. So.
Yeah, I don't think you always get it, but I think that when, if you're the type of band who can reach your audience on a person-to-person level, you should. I mean, you should.
Yeah.
It's something that something that happened to me when I was young and impacted me, and, you know, gave, you know, I think, you know, Seb and I especially very much come from, like, a DIY scene. And, you know, obviously we've outgrown certain elements of that now. We're not sleeping on people's floors every night, but way back when, if you weren't friendly, you didn't find somebody that would put you up and give you a place to sleep.
Yeah, you couldn't be like a prima donna when you're band tour.
Oh, definitely.
You know,
for all the listeners at home, we're on the tour bus with these guys. It's a really cool tour bus, and we walked up to it, and it's got this really sweet gray tribal fire looking sort of logo or part.
By the way, so it also has a name.
It has a name.
The company has a big name. It's called the Arnold.
The Arnold.
Do we want to know why it's called the Arnold?
We don't know. This is called the Arnold.
Yeah.
It's
not our
company's
name.
Website.
Sure.
The buses all have names.
It was we were just like outside wondering if it was Godsmack's tour bus, and then at some point they returned it or something. It's got that sort of really
it seems like the company may have bought all of Godsmack.
Yeah.
So
you have the Decibel Metal and Beer Fest is coming up in a couple days, actually.
Jeez. In a week.
Yeah. Are you ready for that?
Well, we're playing after Obituary, which
so I don't know for real.
Which makes me as a fan, whatever, 25 years ago, whatever it was, and so it's a little scary.
Hopefully, the scary metal guys will be a little tired out by the time
on. I've met the band, at least Donald, the drummer. Mm-hmm. He's like an incredibly nice dude.
Yeah.
I'm just like, it's the metal fans. Like, we're going to be going on after a bunch of words. But whatever, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think, we've done things with Decibel, and they've been, you know, they've really championed our band for a long time now. I'd like to think that the combined audience at that festival is, you know, ready for both an Obituary and a Baroness. So.
I mean, it's also a huge honor. Very, you know, flattered that somebody would consider that.
It's insane. It's kind of insane.
But it's scary.
And I think you're going to find that more often than you certainly used to. With metal fans, people are a lot more playlisty, for lack of a better term. Yeah. You know, I mean, a lot of people will have that kind of variety. And so I'm sure if they go to Obituary and tire their songs out, maybe some Baroness right after that will be, you know, a nice change of pace. I'd like to think so.
It seems like that. Like, we play, during the summer, we typically go to Europe, and we play a lot of metal festivals over there.
Right.
And I promise you, we're an oddball in those stages. Yeah. It always seems like it goes over.
Probably the only drummer without a double kick.
Yeah.
You don't have I guess you wouldn't need one, huh?
No, I don't need one. And nobody's thrown anything at me. Nobody's called me a poser, so it's good.
That's good.
We haven't had middle fingers.
I won't start, so.
Well, since it's a beer festival, what would you want, like, a Baroness beer to be like?
This is
the question.
Because I don't drink anymore. I haven't drank in 20 years.
Yeah. I don't drink either, so it's just a general question for me.
I do drink. And I'm just
gonna... Yeah.
I don't want to, like... Maybe I should edit myself right now. I'm gonna step back. No, I'm gonna say it. I just think that, like... We had, like, the big, giant, you know, corn and rice beers, like Miller and Budweiser. And then there was a reaction to that, whatever, 15 years ago, with the microbrews. And the reaction was to make these, like, really hoppy ales. And that seems to be, like, what everybody brews. And I think that that's only one reaction. The other reaction, it could have been to make an actual proper Pilsner, you know,
that people can drink
that's not hoppy, that's dry and delicious and refreshing. And I have yet, with all the American microbrews we have, I don't think Americans... Americans don't even know what a lager is. No. Brooklyn Lager is not a lager. It's just incorrect. It blows my mind. And so to make a long story short, I wish that there would be like one of those beers.
It's like a really good example of a brand, either from a different country or otherwise.
Well, on our rider, we have Pilsner Urquell from the Czech Republic, which is, you know, we love that beer.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's no American version of that.
They tried. They probably wouldn't do it right.
It's just not.
Maybe it's hard to do. Huh?
It's kind of subtle, is what it is. Right. You know, it's a subtle thing.
So you need to hook up with a brewery and walk them through the steps and tell them how to make it.
I think it's like a flavor war thing where it's
yes.
If you're dealing with toasted
chocolate almond pecan.
Yeah, and like, okay, if you were the American Pilsner Urquell, you go, well, our beer is subtle.
Yeah.
And it's not as strong. And it's not as heady. And And somebody's just going to be like, well, you know, I want the meat lover's pizza.
Yeah,
you
know? Yes, yes. I mean, I think the brewers know. I just think they're not interested in what I just said. They must know. They're not.
Probably know their market here. And
that's the thing. It's a market thing.
So just to switch gears now, talk about...
Sorry about the rant.
No, we love rants.
We're here for, yeah.
But I figure we should talk about Golden Grey, new album coming up. So when you were advertising it, the little trailer that came out had your name in orange. Yeah. The artwork is orange. Now, is the name a reference to going back to a gray sigh and a flower husk, or is this something completely different?
I didn't pick that one out. No, you know, there's a bunch of different ways I can answer this question. There's long ones and there's short ones. I'll say that up until maybe 4 days before we mastered the record, it was going to be orange or something very similar. And we made the decision.
We also were like, there was a couple of months where like we're not going to use a color anymore.
Yeah, for a while. I really did not want to. I didn't want to call it. You know, I think I wanted to be beyond that because the orange thing was like really throwing me off.
The joke that me and all my friends made online was that I think you guys left a really great amplifier endorsement on the table by not naming it orange.
Oh, shit. Well, my smart-ass answer about the color thing is that it's actually not a color. It's a metal and a lack of a color.
Oh.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I heard you say that, and I was thinking about it. You know, we go through this process with the titles where, you know, sometimes it's to avoid, you know, trying to figure out what the record's about and trying to give it a name like that. Sometimes it's, you know, it's a fun visual platform for me, making the artwork. But then there's got, you know, there's got to be a little bit of extra there. And this one, I think more than any other record, take the title and at least personally, I can really, I've got like 20 different riffs on it, you know, all sort of work in a weird way. And, you know, not least of which is like the metal and the lack of color thing. But it's also like, you know, something that's very precious versus an idea that's very cheap.
And also, I mean, like Purple was a pretty concise album, and it's one color.
Yeah.
This, like, I mean, Yellow Green is double album. This is not a double album, but it is more sort of expansive than Purple. It's more varied, and so, you know, that's another way that the title fits it.
Speaking of Purple, I mean, you were nominated for a Grammy for it.
We were nominated.
Yes. Thanks for reminding us.
Wow, Jordan.
I know. I'm sorry. I voted for the Grammys. Yeah. But when you kind of get that recognition on such a big level and then you start working on new music, you know, bands always try to move forward and try to expand their sound and move in different directions. But when you get that recognition previously, I guess, how does that affect songwriting?
I don't think it did.
I don't think it did.
I mean, you haven't heard the record. I think if you heard the record, yeah. You wouldn't even ask that question. I think it's obligatory for forward-thinking bands and for bands that are interested in progression and you know, evolution and everything like that. I think it's absolutely obligatory that you never, ever pay attention to those sorts of awards that you've won or come close to winning or your, you know, your good reviews. You don't base how you write off of stuff like that because that really is, it's hyper-specific, and B, it doesn't, I mean, I think we can all agree that Grammys aren't really the, like, end all be all of, you know, what works
right.
in music.
It's not quite the Oscars.
No. And even the Oscars, I mean, like,
for sure, yeah.
Not necessarily the best movies of all time.
No.
I think, I mean, also, listeners can hear when you're chasing something that's not really you.
Very, very.
And you lose whatever, you know, aesthetic strength you had when you're not doing your thing.
A lot of people that have seen you already on this tour have said it's been great. But Gina's been amazing. Gina shreds. What has the addition of Gina on this album done for you as a band and done for the music?
Well, it's taken the attention away from Sebastian and myself and Nick, for one. That's good.
So. Her days are numbered.
she's an incredible musician. She most definitely got the gig because she can play and because she's got a good personality and she's got a great voice. And she's, you know, an extremely valuable member to our band as a songwriter and performer and all that. So, you know, it's just like when we were, before we did Purple, when Sebastian and Nick joined, you know, I just feel like I'm kind of, like, personally, I just feel like I've gotten lucky, like, year after year, given the fact that there's always been these, like, kind of insane lineup changes and dramatic.
Could have been a total disaster.
It could have been a total disaster, you know, like, we never really had to advertise the fact that we needed somebody, and we always found somebody very organically, without too many phone calls, without too much work. And, you know, you were in the band 10 minutes after we started playing. And Nick, same thing. Gina, same thing. You know, so I think it was always a really simple, quick, easy decision without a whole lot of drama, and that's why it's surprising because it could have just been a train wreck.
Now, I know you do a lot of art. You do the artwork for the band, obviously. Do you start with a specific idea? Like, I know there's been themes throughout, but do you kind of know what you're going to do, or do you just let it happen?
No, it's just like the music. Like, to a certain degree, you know where you're starting, you know. But this most recent record, both musically and visually, there was something of a starting point that was sort of obvious. I mean, especially with the artwork, like I knew this was part of the series, so there's already like a few ground rules that I'd established, but I don't like trying to make something happen. I don't like envisioning something and then trying to see it through until it is exactly what I've, you know, like, if I was able to picture something completely. You know, you just kind of start loosely and then make sure every step you take feels natural and feels good. It's insane. You know, the way we work is insane. It's nuts. It's crazy. It takes a lot of time. It's just like a ton of embellishment, a ton of attention to detail, while at the same time trying to balance out, like, guts and, like, an emotional response. Yeah, it's weird.
I had asked some of the people that read our blog just for some questions they might want to have asked, and one that actually came up a couple times was when you make these really, like, masterful, large album covers with all the imagery they have, is it like a chicken comes before the egg sort of thing? Like, do you play the music first, listen to your own music, get some inspiration from that to kind of make an imagery that matches for it, or do you just kind of prepare something like it and then with that visual in your head work on the music? Is there any connection there at all?
There's a very deep connection.
Of course, yeah.
However, depending on the album, depending on the circumstance, depending on the timing, Sometimes they happen in tandem.
Yeah.
This one didn't. You know, we had really had to finish the record before I could start doing too much with the artwork. And then when that happened, I'm really trying to make sure that the spirit of what we've done is intact through our visual component. And I've learned over the years it's actually kind of a big deal. You know, like when we debut artwork, it can be a pretty big moment for our audience. It's certainly a big moment for me, because that's the side of the band where I'm just kind of alone in a room for 300 or 400 hours, and then
you're more like, John, have you finished yet?
Yeah.
Hello.
So now that the color theme is coming to an end, is there going to be another theme, or are you going to try to get away from themes in the future?
The new theme is the periodic table of the elements.
Oh, you don't want to go with, like, so pizza, hamburger?
That'll be our headline.
Maybe a good idea.
Will be periodic elements.
Yeah. Or, I mean, you could do smells, you could do sounds, call a song, you know, call an album Blammo if you want.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do think that this band's, it's always been nice for us to have themes that blanket our records and don't come across as concepts. I think it gives our listeners less of an idea about what they're about to experience. I think it gives them less, you know, it paints the band into a corner a little bit less in some ways, you know, and trying to give an album title that, you know, again, it's really weird for me when I'm trying to come up with, like, a short phrase or a word that the record means or something.
So that's why it's like Red Album instead of Crimson or something like that. It's kind of somewhat generic.
There's a generic aspect to it, but it's also something that's serial. So as we move on, we know within, you know, a certain degree of expectation of what sort of things we're going to be working with. When we were doing the colors, and was, you know, once we had Red, it was like, okay, in my mind there's five other things we can do. So then the second one was Blue, because it just sort of felt like that was the way it was going. And then Yellow and Green was, because we'd written so much, you know, obviously it was sort of the double thing. And then this, like Seb already mentioned, it doesn't fit on one piece of vinyl. It's not, but it is a single record. It's just got a shitload of music on it. So it felt like the spirit of Yellow and Green was, like, really back with the band. And I think it's, for me, when I was a younger listener, there are bands that would do, like, numeric titles. That always seemed more elegant than, you know, sometimes awkward titles, you know. That
it also just ties the bigger work of the band together.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be, the number thing can seem like a cop-out, too, but it does tie it together.
And it's easier for releasing box sets, too. Just the Crayola set, just send them all out.
Well, I mean, with us, it was like because I knew that I was going to be doing quite a bit of artwork for the band, it seemed like a cool way to give me a starting point every time we had a record. And, you know, and it has been. It's been really awesome. I very much anticipate getting the vinyl for this and then, you know, laying it all out on the merch table, because I think that'll look awesome. I think it's amazing that we made it this far, because it was kind of a joke when we started.
I mean, with all of the artwork, you could presumably do a lithograph of all of them together, and I think fans would be into that.
I'm positive. In fact, that's why we haven't done it yet.
So something on the way, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think this record's a big one for us. We're already geared up to tour more on this record than we have been geared up to tour on the other record. I think, you know, our internal excitement is extremely high. We may have overshot the mark on committing ourselves to touring, but it's, you know, better than the past couple records where we really didn't,
yeah.
You know, for one reason or another, we really didn't get to tour as
much as we should have.
As much as we should have, and as consistently as we should have.
Being too busy is a great problem for a musician to have.
Sure.
Yeah, well, you're heading to South America soon, and you can finally fulfill the come to Brazil meme that
yes.
All metalheads now seem to say. So
it's for real.
The Brazil thing is absolutely real. I get Brazil and Argentina from every time.
We even posted that we were going to Brazil, and somebody commented, and it wasn't Brazilian. It wasn't a joke. It was like there was a comment that just said, come to Brazil. And it's just like, jeez.
You have to double check what you posted to make sure it's actually Brazil.
Right.
So you have, this tour's finishing up, Golden Grey is coming out, you're doing the Decibel show, you're doing South America. What do you do when you're not writing and doing artwork and touring? Like, what's downtime? Is it Netflix? Is it reading?
I genuinely don't remember. I've been doing this for about 2.5 years now.
It's like time traveling. You're here one minute, and then it's 2 years later.
Well, I think at this point, maybe we should give him some sort of semblance of what downtime would look like, and maybe wrap it up here.
That's a good question.
I mean, we've got 26 minutes out of him.
Yeah.
So it's up to you if you got another question for him.
If there's anything else you guys want to talk about.
Anything you want to plug? I mean, besides the album coming out, anything else you want to say or leave everyone off with?
Just, you know, hopefully see some of you guys out at the shows. We're going to be on the road even more this summer, so.
Yeah. For everybody who's missed us on this tour because we weren't playing that specific region, we're doing our absolute best to get back through America and hit all the places that we didn't very soon.
So everyone be patient and leave them alone.
No, not that. We're about to make some announcements. I think we'll make a lot of people happy.
Great. Looking forward to that. Thanks so much, guys. We really appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah, see you soon. Thank you, guys.
One thing I definitely wanted to talk about, one thing I wanted to bring up is that, so it was late that night. Baroness were well into their set. And I'm just going to do an impression of the noise that I heard behind me for about an hour and a half.
We definitely have to talk about
Yeah,
it.
We're going
to
talk about this because this was a big event for me. So I'm just, it's the Palladium, kind of more Eastern Massachusetts. And I just hear something that's just very typical to me, and I'm not going to – there's no words to it because none of it really mattered. But it was just like, ah, bad effect. Oh, my God, Patrick. Oh, and Pat and Brian and David. Oh, my God. And it was just like that for an hour and a half. And then I'm going to tell you guys something. Over the PA system, over the thundering drums, over the booming bass guitar, over the stack of Fender combo amplifiers that Gina and John were playing, over the sound of the crowd roaring, over all of that sound, it didn't matter. There came a booming voice from the heavens, deeper and harder than any voice I've ever heard in my life. And with a resounding, just Gabriel trumpet-like booming, it hollered out, "No one cares!" And that guy was cucked into extreme silence the moment that came about. I mean, he did a little bit of some resistance. He was like, well, I care. I care. Yeah. And then he shut the fuck up the rest of the show. And I had no idea who that voice was. I didn't know where it came from, but I was deeply grateful for it. But man, it was none other than crowd killer extraordinaire, 365 Days of Horror, my boy Jordan, shut this guy so the fuck up. And I'm amazed, man. My respect for you, which was already extremely high, of course, is just now that much higher. You don't fuck around, man.
I will admit that I have a real short tolerance for being annoyed. Like, I get annoyed super easily. I'm free to admit that. In my everyday life, I'm annoyed at least 10 times. But even though I'm annoyed real easily, I let it go on because I'm just like, all right, this will stop. This will end. People will move away. It's not worth getting upset about. It's not worth getting into a fight about. You could easily get into a fight every day if you really wanted to. But obviously, in a situation like this, it's not worth it. It's just people behind us talking and talking and talking.
Extremely loudly, like yelling over the band so that they can hear their own dumb, stupid conversation.
Yeah, this isn't between the sets. This isn't before the show. Whatever, talk, that's fine. But the bands are playing. And it's one thing to like lean over to your buddy and be like, the song's awesome. Or, oh, you got to check this out. That's not what was happening. It was just like bar talk. It was just like they were in a bar or they were in their own apartment just shooting the shit for hours, loudly, right behind us, not moving. And it was during a quiet part, during Baroness. Like, the band's playing, but it's obviously quiet. People are listening. And there's just this conversation, like you said, going on. And finally, I had enough and just had to give out a little no one cares. And like you said, that was it. They really did it.
I noticed the moment that you broke was when he said something along the lines of, like, oh, yeah, and I'm part of the weed smokers of Massachusetts. And then I think that broke us.
That was it. It just that like... was my breathing point.
Because no one fucking cares.
No one cares. Like, how could you possibly be talking about this 4 hours into a show that was not cheap? It was a decent priced show. But, you know, let's say you pay $30 for a ticket and $10 to $15 for service fees and parking, whatever else. How are you spending this much money and not listening to the bands? Why are you here? Yeah. Why are you ruining everyone's good time?
Who has the spare? Because, I mean, God, what were the tickets? $35. And then on top of the ticket fly fucking service fees, which is at least $15, $17 these days, which is just completely criminal, by the way. It's like, it's up there in price. We really paid for these tickets. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Like, why go to a show and just yap your fucking trap the whole time?
About nothing.
About nothing. And it's like, oh, we're the pot smokers of 413. It's like, shut the fuck up. Like, weed's legal. It's not, you're not special. You're not fucking special anymore. Okay? It's not a personality. Shut the fuck up.
So, yeah, if you go to a show, don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't do that to people. But beyond that, it was a really great show.
It was probably one of the better live performances I've seen ever. Like, top five at least, you know. And I've seen a lot of shows, and we've seen shows from huge seminal metal acts, and some of them were like completely outshined even by Zeal and Ardor, who just opened for this, you know. It was fucking incredible. These guys, everybody's energy was on 10. Everybody played perfectly. It was phenomenal. The light show was a bit much, maybe.
Agreed. There was a Zeal and Ardor during their set was a lot of strobing lights from the house lights. I really hate that. Venues need to stop doing that. No more strobing. Def Heaven had their own, you know, six or seven lights set up with different flashing and colors. That was a bit much too. With Baroness, they did have lights, but theirs were, I'm sure most people caught this when seeing them, but whenever they had their stage lights on, it was the color corresponding to the album that the song was on.
And I think people will be very interested to hear in this interview, or have heard in this interview, that indeed they were planning on naming it Orange. Like, that was just
right.
We all were. It was just how it seemed to be. And I didn't get to bring – he kind of went into the speculation about what the chromatic themes mean, and it was just getting to be too much. And I kind of got what he was saying, because I've had people – or I've heard people say, like, oh, well, they call it purple because purple is red and blue mixed together. And no, it's not. Like, that's not why it's named that way, you know?
Well, I think with things like that where it's kind of vague, and we do this not just with a band like Baroness. We do this in music and outside too, we have our own theories and things kind of make sense to us. Like even in our interview, I ask him about if the gray in Golden Gray was a reference to their very first EP. And it wasn't, but no. It kind of, you got to see on his face and hearing his voice. He's like, oh, well, yeah, actually, that's a good point.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, no, I missed that. Yeah, no, great bunch of guys. I hope if we do interviews in the future, it's a lot more like that.
Yeah, I mean, you always hope it goes well and they don't hate your guts.
Also, I didn't talk as much, which is important.
Well, you almost broke their guitar.
I did almost. They had this this little cheap acoustic guitar that was just sitting around. I didn't almost break it, but I was bonking it around trying to like find a safe place for it. And
there was very little room for us to sit, and their acoustic guitar was on one of the seats, right. And tried to like sit next to it and, like you said, bonked into it.
I'm a very large man, and sometimes I underestimate my massive muscular form, you know, from all that working out.
Zealand Ardor was great. I mean, like, really great. A lot of people were super impressed by them. Def Heaven, you know, I've seen them before in a smaller venue.
Mm-hmm.
This was good, too. I'm not super familiar with all of their songs, so they played for an hour, and it kind of felt like an hour, whereas some bands it doesn't feel as long. But I think that's partially because they have long songs,
yeah,
and a lot of them have a similar sound. So it's not like with a band like Baroness where you might hear one song and then the other one sounds completely different. With them, it kind of felt like one long song for an hour.
Yeah.
So if you like them, like, that's great. If you're kind of, you know, a little bit about them, it does drag on a little bit.
They're heavy as shit, too. They're like a real metal band. People don't, I mean, they see the outfits, they see the band photos, and they just get mad, and that's pretty much it. But they're incredible live, and I watched George Clark. This guy is like the hypest front man I've ever seen. He is just constant energy, swinging his neck around, freaking the fuck out. At one point, the bro took out a tambourine and was just smashing it against like the microphone stand while, you know, in perfect rhythmic unison with the rest of the band. It was phenomenal. They did a great job. Their light show, though, I wasn't, because it's just these huge blaring LED lights in rings that they have all over the stage. And it's like, man, I wear glasses. I got dirty glasses because I'm in a show. And it's just like, ugh, my fucking eyes. The glare is immense.
And Baroness was great.
Baroness was great.
And I think it's a credit to all three bands that they sounded so great in a venue that's notoriously shitty for sound.
Yes. Notoriously shitty.
Like all three bands, their first song or two had audio problems, not because of the band, but because apparently this venue that's been around for what, decades,
yes,
and has a professional sound equipment and sound people can't figure out how to do things.
And the Palladium is pretty much like the stop for major metal acts as far as going on tour for Massachusetts or a lot of the Northeast, like the Palladium.
Yeah, if they don't want to play Boston, they'll play Worcester.
Yeah, because it's easier. Boston is, I'm sure, one of the worst places in the world to fucking drive a tour bus around. So, you know.
And yet some bands, every tour, hit up Boston.
Don't do it, man. Go to the Palladium. It's great. It's dead center of Massachusetts. So everybody from Massachusetts will go to the Palladium who's a fan of your band. So Boston, I will sit out a Boston show. You know, I will, like, it could be one of my favorite bands, like Alcest played a year ago or something. I'm just like, fuck, man, I really don't want to go park in Boston, walk in Boston, and take an Uber in Boston and just deal with all the bullshit and all the roads and all the fucking traffic and stress. And some cities are just like that. A lot of cities in the US, and, you know, people will not go to your show if you go to a shitty city.
Yeah, I think if people have never been to Boston, they don't know how the city is set up. Whereas like New York City is on a grid.
Yes.
And you could be like, I am on 58th Street. I need to get to 42nd Street. I just need to go this way.
Right.
With Boston, its streets are one way, halfway, and then they're both ways once you cross this bridge, and it's weird curves and dead ends and street names don't make sense, and there's no parking, and if there is parking, it's super expensive. Like when I saw Monster Magnet a few months ago in Cambridge, it was $25 to park.
No, fuck that. It was $20 to park across the Palladium.
Yeah.
Fucking nuts. And like last time I was in Boston to go see my brother graduate from the academy. He's a cop. So I go to, I'm just like cross, the light turns green and I just start driving forward. And then the fucking T just blows right through the intersection. Just a fucking full speed subway. Just how the fuck could I have possibly expected that if I was not from the area, you know? Jesus Christ.
And everyone's rude and has stupid accents.
I mean, that's everywhere. That's just America, baby.
But the Boston accent's pretty bad. I think it's frequently voted the worst accent in the country.
Everyone in the comments below, tell us what the worst accent is. Not just in the U.S., but in the world. But, I mean, in the U.S. too. That's fun.
I mean, I can't think of a worse one.
Oh, man. I mean, I used to date a girl from Wisconsin. That was pretty bad.
So what does that sound like?
Oh, crap. Crap.
Golly gee, you betcha.
Oh, my God. Well, it's, I know the guys are from, like, I know John's from Georgia, but you would never know it hearing him talk. He's just such a, like, straight talker. And he's, you know, the guy's just so well spoken, man. I envy that because I have a podcast and I'm not. Every other word is like, yeah, you know.
Well, maybe we can be BFFs with him now.
Oh, we already are. That's just how it is.
So speaking of shows, have you seen the lineup for Cycle Las Vegas?
A little bit.
It is a ridiculous lineup. Like, my hat's off to the organizers. When you see some of these fests, somewhat in the United States, but more often in Europe, it's a weird mixture of, like, here's a black metal stage, here's a punk stage, here's this and that, and sometimes the bands blend together where you'll get, like, Dimmu Borgir, and then directly underneath them is, like, NoFX.
Yeah.
And I think they're trying to cram all these bands on because they don't tour that much, and I get that, but it's always kind of a weird, at least outsider perspective, a weird thing to look at. Like, if I went to this, like, what kind of people would be there? Who would I go see? Would this actually happen? But with Cycle Las Vegas, it's clearly going towards, like, the doom, stoner, kind of groovier metal bands. And just looking at this is over the course of a couple of days. You've got Clutch, Godspeed You Black Emperor, High on Fire.
Oh, wow.
Black Religion, Bad Religion, Fu Manchu, Carcass, Rotting Christ, Power Trip, Old Man Gloom, 1349, The Obsessed, Yob, a whole bunch of bands, Full of Hell, Cadaver, Violence for some reason. And they all kind of fit into that theme, Electric Wizard. You get it. You know what you're seeing.
Right, right.
And they just announced the two, like, major headliners, which even before announcing any headliners, I don't think they even need more headliners. They have a ton of bands on this, and I don't know if it's sold out, but I know it's selling very well.
Right.
But they added Opeth and Megadeth, which Megadeth. Seems real weird to me.
Top bill, Megadeth. After,
like,
all
why Megadeth? It's not even anything against Megadeth or Dave Mustaine. I know we've talked about them ad nauseum for years at this point.
Right.
But, like, they really don't fit, and they're not needed on this.
Well, I mean, for me, it's like, I like Megadeth as much as I trash them because, I mean, they don't make good music anymore, and they're not good people. But I just, like, why? Why this? Why this band? It's like they just were able to land them, and it's like, oh, fuck it, you're the headliner. Opeth, I could see, you know?
Opeth makes sense in kind of their dad prog rock sound now.
For sure.
It's not what I want to hear. I want to hear the older stuff. The old stuff, but it's true.
Right. And God knows they'll play it, you know?
Well, they're not going to bust out, like, My Arms, Your Hearse, probably. I mean, they might.
Fuck it, why not? Cycle Las Vegas, baby. Anything can happen.
Yeah, I mean, there are heavy bands on this, so it's entirely possible, but I don't want to sit through an hour of the noodly dad rock jazz times to hear Deliverance. So,
I'm on the VivaPsycho.com webpage looking at the lineup, and they have some socks for sale, some psycho socks.
What makes them psycho socks?
Well, let's talk about it. We got some red and black socks. Got some red stripes on them. There's a sword, a red sword, a red sure. like oni face, like a Japanese style demon face on kind of the front of the socks, and then the bottom of the feet. It says "Long live" on one sock, and then it says "The Dream" on the other sock. I feel like I would get those mixed up with other socks, so it would just say "The Dream" and then some other sock I would have.
Well, you could pretend it's a NXT sock for Velveteen Dream.
It'll just say like "Long live Haynes" or something on like the two mix up.
It's weird at what merch gets made. Like socks? Do we really need socks?
Anthrax made some socks, and I was definitely going to send them to Joe last year, but I like them a little too much. I just didn't want to. I didn't want to spend $30 on something he'd throw away.
Yeah, they're expensive, and they're socks. You're never even really going to see them.
And they're fucking stupid.
Yeah.
And there was like the worst one. It was like the Anthrax mascot with the mustache. I don't even know the name. Like, I like Anthrax, and I don't even care.
Yeah, it's just beyond like shirts and hoodies. Merch can get a little weird. Like, sometimes, all right, shorts, sure, you can put your name on the butt. Hats, that makes sense. And then it gets into blankets and gloves and thongs.
Thongs are the worst. Or, like, bikinis.
Weed grinders.
Yeah.
Slayer wine.
At the Baroness show, John works with a pedal company, so he's got, like, his own fuzz pedal. And generally, fuzz pedals are just known for being these cheaper pedals because there's not a lot going on to the circuit of that electronic. They're usually like 50-ish bucks or so. But this one he was selling at the merch table for $200 a piece.
So, I think that's genius because that's the right crowd that would actually buy a $200 pedal.
Oh, yeah. A lot of Baroness people I talk to are like guitar guys. Like, because they're not a very typical metal band, and we talked about that in the interview, but a lot of people, like, people on Twitter shit on them all the time because they're just not, you know, gurgle gurg donk donk donk.
Well, that's
slam metal.
Twitter is a cesspool that people like to fool themselves into thinking it's not as bad as Facebook, but it is.
It's a little worse in its own ways. It just has things.
You can have strangers bothering you, whereas on Facebook I don't think they can. I mean, not to the degree that you can on Twitter.
Facebook is a lot more close-knit. You kind of niche out your own little universe on Facebook, whereas that's not the case at all on Twitter. It's pretty much a free-for-all. Even if you do think that you've niched out your own little section, like, I swear to God, I will unfollow people and mute them, and they still constantly show up in my TL. And I know it's them because Twitter now is saying, like, you can't view this tweet. Click here to view this tweet. And it's like, oh, God, of course now I'm going to fucking click on it.
Yeah, well, you can see entire conversations of this tweet is not available.
Right, and it's like, oh, man, who's this? Who is this particular piece of shit I didn't want to hear from anymore? Let me see what's going on with his life.
Because you can't help yourself.
And metal Twitter specifically is just, I mean, what we call quote-unquote metal Twitter, it's very strange.
And there's great people. There are people that we are friends with and we love talking to and hearing from.
Yeah.
And then there's not.
Nope, fuck all of you. I don't care. If you like the show, fuck you. I hate you. No, it's not true. Although every time I share an episode, it's like, you know, I'll share some dumb meme and it gets 2,000 likes, but I'll share an episode and it gets 1.5 like. I guess
of course.
2 likes and then 1.5 means 2 likes and then somebody, you know, unchecks it because they accidentally liked it.
You don't get the instant gratification of here's a silly picture with some top text, bottom text. It's like, I got to listen to something. I don't have time to listen to things. I'm looking at memes.
I have more top text and bottom text to read. 7.5 hours from now, I'm going to go to...
You just had a Twitter issue this past week, didn't you?
I don't know if I'd call it an issue, but yeah. This is what happens. Is like, I just trash post all the time. Like, everything I say is a stupid joke or something that's kind of serious, but it's usually my ratio is maybe 1 retweet, 20, 30 likes. Not bad. You know, I got a little less than 2,000 followers. It's like, I don't expect much from anything.
Look at this guy. I got a little less than 2,000 followers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I was like a hot girl, I would have like 22,000 easy. Easy. Fucking easy. But I'm just a hot dude, so not a rare commodity. An extremely hot, sexy dude, so.
So what happened?
Okay, so I wrote this tweet about nails. And people like it when you dunk on nails, I guess. I have
because it's easy and it's funny.
It's easy and it's funny. And trust me, I heard all about low-hanging fruit. Man, shut the fuck up. I don't know. So Nails, they released a, I think it's like a 7-inch Flexi just recently. I thought it was their new album title, but it's just one of their new songs and then another new song that features Max Cavalera from Soulfly.
Mm-hmm.
So the name of the release was I Don't Want to Know You. And that kind of reminds me of their last release, which is You Will Never Be One of Us. So I just kind of made a list just of shit posting, and the list went as follows. Nails 2016, You Will Never Be One of Us. Nails 2019, I Don't Want to Know You. Nails 2022, You Can't Sit With Us. Nails 2026, My Mom Says I'm Not Supposed to Hang Out With You. Nails 2029, You're Not Invited to My Sweet 16 Party. And that was it. And it's now got 500, it's now got 600 retweets. And
jeez.
2,000 something likes. And it's just such a fucking one-off flame joke that I've seen 100 kind of times. And I don't know, I guess I just might have gotten the right formula. So now I have a lot of people who, and people on Twitter can't help but do this. They try to one-up your jokes if you say something funny. They try to suck that precious clout from you. Because it happens. We see it on Twitter all the time. Somebody retweets an otherwise kind of popular tweet, but they clap back on it in such a way that their tweet gets like 10 times the retweets and shit. So you get that constantly if you have a popular tweet. People will always try to one-up the joke, and it just never lands. A lot of it is just like my friends on Twitter, just like, you know, snowballing ideas and laughing and having a good time off. And just like, you know, and a lot of it was like angry Nails fans. I had this one guy who says, if a lot of people hate a band, you know, there's really something special. And then I just like in a hot second, like replied, you must be really something special then, huh? But then I just, I deleted it. I didn't fucking send it.
It's just not worth it, man.
Nails fans like that. And I mean, this guy had like 40 followers. You knew that like this would be the first time anyone ever talked to him on Twitter. So he would just be at me all day and I would just be babysitting my insult. You know, that fucking shit you do on Twitter where you clap back at somebody and then you're just babysitting the tweet all day. You're refreshing the tweet. You're seeing, waiting for them to say something else stupid so you can write another limited character, stupid bumper sticker ass response back at them. And then it's just back and forth. Just a bullshit time waste all around.
It's worth it. You just let that go.
Just let it go.
You going to fight with someone with 30 followers who you don't know, doesn't follow in anyone you know, somehow came across what you said? It's not worth it.
No. I did get back at one guy, though. He wrote like something like Nails 2050, still cared about and loved and more relevant than anybody who's involved in this tweet. And then I just replied,
I can guarantee you that is not true.
And then I added him. I was just like, and taking this seriously. And that's all I said. And like maybe one person liked it. And that was enough for this guy to fucking delete his tweet. Just red faced and mad and nude online.
Don't be a wiener.
Yeah, go fuck off. Go watch sports ball, bro. Yeah, normie. But here's the thing. Here's the thing when you have a tweet that does well. Lots of people who you kind of just figure are your peers, they gotta knock you down a peg. They just gotta fucking start sniveling all around your timeline about how like, yeah, this hot Nails takes are getting so fucking old and lame, guys.
Yeah, you could probably edit that.
Fuck him. No, he won't listen. All right, I'll edit it.
It's not worth it.
It's worth it. I want to fight. I want fights. I want this clout vampirism to end, man. Everybody's always got to be talking shit.
And subtweeting. It's like people can see that. We see what you're saying. We know who you're talking about. We all follow the same people. We all talk to the same people.
Yeah. I'm subcasting right now. I'll edit that.
You're on another level.
I'm on a whole other level, man. You got to listen an hour and a half into my show to hear me talking shit about you. So you better listen to everyone. Because you never know who's next.
And another thing about Joe Thrash and Kale.
Yeah, Joe. Joe won't even listen to these, man. He's having too much fun.
Well, he's got to come back to reality now. He's leaving Japan. He's coming back to the U.S. where everyone's fat and gross. And he's going to have to pay bills and probably never go on another vacation again.
Yeah, it's like all of America is sumo village. We're all just training for it, for our day in the ring. It's just like you were saying, it's just, of course, I recognize you're talking about me, and it's like you must have some weird fucking manipulative, Machiavellian, passive-aggressive, like, absolute strategy in me reading this and, like, you know, my heart getting hurt. So now I just fucking at people, and I like the tweet, or I say, like, now I say shit. I just say shit now. But then it's like you call them out, and they're like, oh, but why? It's not what I meant. I saw lots of people on Twitter.
Have you ever seen Grindhouse, the movie Grindhouse?
Grindhouse, like the
Quentin
feature.
Tarantino.
Yeah.
And
double feature? Yeah, you know, I saw that, yep.
The second movie is Death Proof, and for those who haven't seen it, it's Kurt Russell attacking women with his car, essentially. It's kind of the old, like, 70s hot rod revenge-type movie. And anyway, there's a scene where the women finally get their hands on Kurt Russell, and he's screaming, like, why? What did I do? And that's kind of, like, the same thing with this situation.
It's like you guys are the meme where the guy's on a bicycle with a stick, and then he suddenly, like, jabs the stick in the spokes of his wheel and falls down holding his knee, and he's like, fucking Brennicide!
So the point is, don't go on Twitter.
Yeah, delete your Twitter. God knows I will. In the next, like, I don't know, 10 or 20 years or so, I'll delete Twitter.
Follow us at Toilet of Hell, at That's Not Metal, at 365 Days of Horror, by the way, because God, I need followers and likes to keep me sustained.
Yeah, please do. And next week, we're going to get Joe back, and it's going to be one hell of a comeback, baby. He has been on his glorious adventure, finding himself and his culture in lands far distant away, and he shall return, the prodigal son, the true master of Toilet of Hell.
He has played with capybaras. He has gotten drunk. He's gotten drunk in public. He's gotten drunk at his hotel room. And hopefully he bought us things. We didn't ask, but now I kind of wish I had. But maybe we'll get some stuff.
Hopefully stuff to make us drunk.
Well, you drunk. I'll have candy.
Yeah, just candy and, you know, get drunk. That's what I do.
That's the American way.
All right, fellas. We're going to wrap it up here. Y'all keep it metal. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Cool. Very good show.
listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.
Fucking bullshit!